Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And
as we know, it is fire weather here in Utah.
We got a fire update.
And across the nation.
Yep.
We're going to have a fire update for you. And then we are going to go back to renowned writer and journalist John Valiant, who talks about his most recent book, Fire Weather, which is a true story from a hotter world in which he describes the science of fire and forest health, the fascinating relationships between humans and fire, and the future of fire-related disasters.
And John's giving a talk tonight.
That's right. He's going to be, so this is a preview for you.
So listen in, learn about it, and then have your questions for John when he gives his talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the Park City Library. John, thank you so much for joining Claire and me on This Green Earth.
Hi there. So good to be with you.
Great to have you. The book is really interesting. It talks about, among other things, of course, the science of wildfires, the prevalence of more and more wildfires and intense wildfires. But its main protagonist, I guess we'll say, is the 2016 Fort McMurray wildfire that occurred in Alberta, Canada. Remind us about that fire and why it was so damaging and unique.
Well, May 3rd, 2016, kind of marked a turning point, I think, in our relationship to what I call 21st century fire. And we've seen an awful lot of it in the past decade. But May 3rd, 2016 was when a wildfire about 6 miles wide and 300 feet tall swept into Fort McMurray, Alberta. Fort McMurray, Alberta is about 800 miles north of you, north of Salt Lake City, deep in the boreal forest on a latitude with southern Alaska. It's a very isolated place, but it's the capital, it's the petroleum hub of Canada, and it's the source of about 4 million barrels a day of petroleum products that are pipelined out of that region and over the border into American refineries. So the idea of what is effectively the Houston of Canada being overrun by fire and triggering the largest, most rapid evacuation due to fire in modern times was a signal event. And because it happened in Canada, it didn't get Americans' attention the way the LA fires did, the way the Paradise fire did, the way the Lahaina fires did. But all those fires were basically follow-ups to what happened in Fort McMurray, where the temperatures inside the city were exceeding 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and houses, $500,000 two-story modern North American houses were burning to the ground, to the basement in 5 minutes flat.
Wow. And just as an aside, this oil producing region is the oil comes in the form of bitumen, which is actually, if I understand it correctly, is a surface excavated process. It's not like putting a pipe down, a straw down into the ground and pulling oil out. We're used to. This is a really, really dirty form of oil. Do I got that right?
You sure did. It's the dirtiest, most inefficient, most environmentally and financially costly way to recover hydrocarbons ever devised. Bitumen is basically a driveway sealer. But in the case of Alberta, it's soaked in sand.
Hmm.
So they mine it like coal, and then they heat it up with billions of cubic feet of natural gas per day to melt this stuff into something that will move through a pipeline. And then they load it up with petroleum distillates that enable it to stay liquid and can be transported into specially designed refineries on the U.S. border that can handle this incredibly dirty fuel. It's basically liquid tar.
Right.
Most oil, as we know, floats. This is the only petroleum product that sinks in water.
Wow, and that's a good point. It actually requires fossil fuels in the form of natural gas to produce this fossil fuel, which then needs more fossil fuels to keep it liquid enough and warm enough so that it can be pumped.
Exactly. And then it needs more fossil fuels to refine it a second time into petroleum products that our engines and power plants can recognize.
Okay.
And the only reason they can do it is because it's sold at a tremendous discount, and they can do it in massive quantities relatively cheaply. But once oil starts to drop below $55, $50 a barrel, and it's not far from there right now, it starts to become a loser.
Okay.
And so most of the year, it used to be, there was a global involvement in this industry 15 years ago, and they fled. The Norwegians and the Chinese have hung in there, but most other European and Western companies have abandoned it, partly because it has such a bad look environmentally, but also because it's a really inefficient fuel and clearly out of step with the needs of the current era.
Got it.
So when you're investigating this fire and trying to understand it and what happened, and you come back to this understanding first of our relationship as humans to fire and how we're intrinsically linked to it, can you walk us through that evolution of humans and fire and why that makes such a big difference as you explore it and investigate it?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Claire. That really was a big digression for me, but ended up being central to the story because I started thinking about all the stuff we burn. And I started looking around my house and realizing everything in my home is at some point mediated through fire's energy. You know, if it's a metal, it has to be heated up and melted into a form that I can use. So many of the products we have, our running shoes, our Lululemon joggers, our mattresses are made from petroleum distillates, our garbage cans. I mean, everything in our modern world is that some way mediated through the energy or the products of fossil fuels. And so I started looking at the history of that burning and our relationship to fire. And fire, as I kind of eventually discovered, besides, you know, our tremendous brains and our ability to speak and our opposable thumbs and our ability to function, operate communally, the other superpower we have is our ability to manipulate fire. And so from the very beginning, when we started just taking burning sticks out of wildfires and waving them around and realizing we can light up the darkness and scare away predators and keep ourselves warm and cook our food, we have stayed really close to fire. And to the point that now, if we were to count the number of fires humans make every day around the world, everything from burning off stubble in an agricultural field to a biomass burner to internal combustion engines, we ignite trillions of fires every day. And I just imagined for a moment, what if we could see all the fires humans make? And it would be like this flickering galaxy of flame on planet Earth. And if we were Martians, looking down at the planet at nighttime, looking at human activities, there would be fires all around us, in our car engines, in our homes, at our dinner tables, in our stoves, in our hot water heaters. And if you could see them all, it would be this flickering galaxy, and an alien might think, wow, that is one dedicated fire cult down there. They are really, really like fire, and everything they do involves burning. And so that was interesting to realize how closely we are allied to it. And then I started thinking that human beings and fire have a lot in common. We're both energy consuming, gas generating, heat generators. And so we off-gas CO2, fires do too. We generate heat, so do fires. We're constantly looking for more fuel, whether it's money to pay our bills and buy our food or food that we're actually going to eat. And that's why fire moves around too. It's looking for more food. So I realized, you know, we're almost allies. We have a lot in common, and we kind of energize each other. We're a little bit like drinking buddies who kind of encourage each other to do more and more wild and outlandish things.
Well, it's interesting you say that. It feels like almost there's also this battle of control between humans trying to control fire. And you've described it also as a predator. So you're giving it these very human characterizations, but I think it helps people understand our relationship with it and what it means to the world and our planet and how we'll always have a relationship with it.
Oh, it's inevitable. And fire is part of our world the same way any other form of weather is. Rain and storms and lightning, you know, they're just part of the package if you live on planet Earth. And I think it's fair to call fire a hunter. Obviously, it doesn't have the same kind of intellectual intention that we do or that our tiger does, but it's got a kind of bottomless appetite. And, you know, if you set fire to the mattress, the fire is not going to be content with the mattress. It's going to burn the bedspread. Mm. It's going to try to catch onto the curtains. It'll burn the house down if it can, and it'll go to the neighbor's house if at all possible. And that's what we're seeing now is just the ferocity and the rapacity of these fires. And right now, Canada is burning so badly and so aggressively that I'm actually speaking to you from France across the Atlantic Ocean. And when I look up at the sky, there is haze from Canadian wildfires all over France, all over Western Europe right now. And what we're seeing is a hotter world, a drier world, and these are conditions that allow fire to behave with more aggression and to basically indulge a bigger appetite. And it's quite dangerous, not just for our lungs, but for our communities. And there are 30,000 Canadians on the road now, evacuated because of the threat of wildfire in their communities.
That's right. I just wanted to add to that what you said, that right now, or as of Sunday, there are 227 active wildfires across Canada, including about 20 now in Ontario, which is a very heavily, relatively speaking, a more populated province in Canada. 7.5 million acres of forest have been burned, which is roughly 12,000 square miles, or in Utah is like 1/7 of Utah has burned.
To date.
Yeah, exactly. If you just join us, we're speaking with John Valiant, author of the book Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. And it was a 2023 National Book Award finalist. So, John, what are the primary sources of these fires, say, up in Canada? What's going on there? And is that increasing?
Well, there's a pretty common mix, you know, and this is similar for Alaska too. Lightning is a major cause of fires in remote areas, mm-hmm. and a lot of northern Canada is remote. And as the climate warms, with every degree of warming, you get about, I think, 7 or 12% more lightning. And so we're getting storms now in Alaska and across the north where you will have thousands of lightning strikes in a single storm. And not all of them ignite in a wildfire, but you don't need that many to ignite in order to make a potentially terrible fire. So So that's a major contributor. But around settled areas, this is, you know, going back to, you know, what we were speaking about earlier, fire follows us everywhere we go. And so it could be a campfire that wasn't properly doused. It could be a hot muffler on an ATV.
Right.
It could be sparks from a chain that's dragging behind your truck.
Yeah.
It could be any number of things that could start a fire. And it might even just be a smolder. And it might just smolder for a week, and then you get a particularly hot day or a stiff wind, and that fire that looked like it was nothing, that no one could even see a week ago, is now raging out of control. And then, you know, there's a lot of concern about arson. And, you know, arson is a factor, but it's not what makes fires terrible. What makes fires terrible are elevated temperatures and reduced humidities. And that's the real recipe for disaster. And as you raise the temperature of the earth, you heat up the forest floor, you heat up all the fuels in the forest, and that also lowers their humidity. And so they become drier and easier to burn. And you know all about that in around Salt Lake City, where if you go camping in the woods there, it's pretty easy to start a fire because the wood is so dry and it gets so hot so fast.
Well, just to kind of supplement your examples there, the largest fire we had here in recent years, it was 600 acres or so, relatively small, but very close to Park City, occurred when a car coming up Parley's Canyon was having difficulty making its way up the canyon, pulled over, and the catalytic converter was hot enough that the car pulled over in the grass, dried grass, high winds, high fire risk day. The fire started, the people in the car, in a minute or two, the fire became out of control. They couldn't put it out. Boom, 600 acres burned during the course of the next 24 to 36 hours. So, it takes one bolt of lightning. It takes one hot catalytic converter. It takes one chain dragging behind a car that sets sparks. These days, there's a lot of more fire danger out here. And of course, here out here west in our storms, a lot of our thunderstorms are dry, right? So to speak, they're not the classic southeast U.S. eastern thunderstorms that have a lot of rain with them. So we have a lot of dry storms that make the lightning even more risky. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, and also out west, trains start a lot. Because their sparks. Wheels throw sparks all the time. And if you have the right conditions, we've had some terrible fires in Canada started by trains. And, you know, these are just human beings doing their job.
Right.
You know, living their normal lives, being conscientious, you know, driving the car safely, pulling over when it gets too hot. That's a sensible thing to do. But we're not always able to factor in the fact that, wow, the car is now so hot that it's going to light up the surroundings. And because it's a little bit hotter and a little bit drier, that fire is going to be out of control more quickly. And that's what we're finding more and more often. And, you know, L.A. was a really graphic example of that, where you had 80-mile-an-hour winds and essentially a kind of a blast furnace effect in these neighborhoods. And there's really nothing... Those are unfightable fires. There's nothing a firefighter can do except try to get their crew out of there safely, along with the citizenry.
Last couple minutes, how does the Fort McMurray fire end? How long did it burn, and when did it finally go out?
Well, it must have set a record, I think, for the time burning within city limits. It burned for about a week.
Hmm.
And the rain never came, the heat never let up, and neighborhood after neighborhood was leveled. And finally they got a grip on it, but it kept burning through the forest. It kept moving eastward. It went all the, you know, Alberta's a huge province. It's bigger than Texas. Moved out of Alberta into Saskatchewan, another huge province. It then burned through the summer and fall, went underground, into the root system during the winter, came up again in the spring, and was not declared fully out until August of 2017, which was 15 months later.
Wow. So eventually, you know, winter, the seasons play a role in at least driving that fire underground, not humans per se.
And what they're just discovered, Mike Flanagan, a very well-respected fire scientist from Western Canada, said, who's been studying wildfires since the 1970s. So that's, you know, it was another world then, you know, environmentally. But he said for the first time he's seen wildfires go subterranean 2 years running. In other words, the same fire burning through the summer, going underground in the winter and popping up again the next summer, and then going underground and popping up again the next spring. In other words, this is a continuous fire, basically burning since the terrible fire season of 2023, which was the worst fire season in Canadian history. And that's what smoked out a lot of the eastern states and Europe too. And it looks like we are setting up for a similar fire season this year, unfortunately.
So in your book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World, you take readers through kind of the history about fire, and then you go into this particular fire in Canada, and then maybe a look into what might lie ahead for us. Can you share a little bit about your thoughts on the future, or where we're at now, and that what that's leading us toward, and maybe how to mitigate it?
Yeah, I wrote this. So this all happened in 2016, 10 years ago. And think of the fires that we can reel off by name now that have killed Americans, that have killed people in Spain, in Portugal, in Australia, in Greece, and in Canada. Most of those fires had not ignited in 2016. And so when I saw Fort McMurray burn the way it did, I thought, my goodness, you know, we're entering a new fire regime. And these terrible fires that have followed since then, you know, LA being the most recent and most notorious, but one of many at this point since 2016, I just thought I wanted to sound an alarm and also help people understand the role that the petroleum industry plays, not only in causing this, but in prolonging it by delaying climate action. And that's really it. We're in a very cynical situation right now. And, you know, in the United States, we're now in a full state of climate denial. Alberta is too, but many other nations, fortunately, are being honest about the role petroleum plays in climate change and are working very, very hard to transition into renewable energy. China, of course, is leading the charge by leaps and bounds. But other nations and states, too, are making really meaningful, needle-moving progress on moving away from fossil fuels, which generate CO2 and methane that makes our climate hotter and more flammable, and moving into wind, solar, tidal, and geothermal, and hydropower. And that's that's our pathway out. That and just reducing the amount of energy we use. And AI is pushing us in the wrong direction as far as that goes. So we're in a very tense moment right now. This generation will be the defining generation for our climate future. And there is real progress being made, but we're experiencing some real setbacks too. And right. Meanwhile, these fires continue to burn.
Right. John, thank you so much, and we'll see you in July.
Take care, and I wish you all clear skies.
Thank you very much, John.
Same to you. Thank you, John, for joining us. And joining us now, we have Sarah Jo Dickens from Ecology Bridge and local mountain bike enthusiast Mike Sesney, who are going to come on to talk about an opportunity to clear out some noxious weeds overtaking some of our more popular mountain biking trails here at Park City Mountain. So welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good morning.
I am excited about this because this all came about, Mike, because you are an avid mountain biker and are paying attention to what's happening. It's almost like citizen science where you're out there and you're thinking this might not be the best thing for this area as these noxious weeds come up. So talk me through that thought process and the actions that you took because of this.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on my bike. And I've noticed over the last couple of years that it seems like the thistle population in many parts of the trails that I spend a lot of time on has been proliferating the last couple of years. And at first, I just kind of grumbled and thought to myself, you know, that's a bummer. I hate these thistles. They're a bummer to have around. And then I started thinking, well, what can I do about it? You know, not just grumble. And so I started kind of doing some thistle mitigation on my own. And then I started talking to some friends of mine about doing a volunteer day. And then it occurred to me that maybe the problem's a little bit bigger than my limited group of friends can tackle. So I decided to reach out to Mountain Trails Foundation. So I did, and Laura Anthony, the executive director, put me in touch with Sarah Jo, and we've just kind of run from it from there. I've been out and about the last couple of weeks. Maybe people have seen me with a giant garbage bag cutting thistle flowers off and pulling the plants out. And I'm just trying to figure out a way to maybe put a dent in the problem and make it a little bit better. So.
Yeah. So you went through the proper channels, though, and I think that's a good lesson here, too, Sarah Jo, because as we were talking a little bit earlier, you had said that there are certain ways in which it is best to take care of these noxious weeds, and to understand what that process is makes a big difference, because you can actually exacerbate the problem accidentally if you're not doing it properly. So walk us through some of these channels, and first of all, why it was great that Mike reached out, and then what your part in this is.
So what was great about the way that Mike did this is that he reached out to an organization that is already part of a large partnership working on noxious weeds. And so Laura was able to quickly reach back out to me through the Summit CWMA, so the Cooperative Weed Management Area. And because of that partnership, we also knew that we could reach out to Vail, who we're actively working with right now, to help them develop a weed plan for both resorts. And so there's a lot of action happening in the background for them to start moving forward on really making a difference with those weeds. But until we're able to help them do that, relying on this partnership that we have with Mountain Trails, but also Park City Municipal, who's stepping up for this event as well. You know, I think I've mentioned before other partners like Basin Rec, other people that deal with the trail system in open space. We're already all at the table. We're all ready to try and make events happen if we have volunteers that want to step up and make a difference. I mean, we do have the garlic mustard games, right? And then we have our Noxious Weed Ambassador program on a lot of our trails. We're always wanting to do more if we have community members who want to participate. And so Mike not only saw a problem, but he called Mountain Trails and said, hey, what can we do? And so we tapped into that partnership and were able to create this event that will be held Thursday night to try and address some of the probably mostly thistle at the base of PCMR and try and get them out of the trails, because nobody enjoys being hit by thistle while they're biking.
All right, for those who are not familiar with thistle, describe it. How many different varieties are there, flowering things? Give them a visual.
So the one we'll probably deal with is called musk thistle. This is the one that has the big pink flower. It's like somewhere between a tennis ball to a softball size. Mm. And the plant can be anywhere from about a foot to 10 feet tall. Huh. So they can become pretty monstrous. There will also likely be scotch thistle, which is also a very big thistle sometimes, right, but the leaves are white. The flowers are smaller, and they're more like a light pink color.
Huh. Okay.
There will probably be Canada thistle. We're not going to touch that. And the reason we're not touching that is because it's a perennial with a very deep root system. Us pulling it really isn't going to make a difference.
And that's what you got to do. You got to pull it to make a difference, not just cut it.
100%. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Even these biennials. So musk and scotch, this are a biennial. So, you know, they grow right one year and they just lay kind of flat on the ground. This little plant we call a rosette, and then the second year is when they become the monsters and develop those flowers, and then they're done. After that, they're done. So even those, if you just cut them down mid-season, they'll try and flower again and produce seed. However, that second round of flowering, there'll be less flowers and less seed. So I don't want people to think that if you're on a trail and you cut it down mid-season, you're not doing any good. You are. You have reduced the amount of seed. It's better than doing nothing.
Okay.
Right? With Canada thistle, though, it's sort of like just taking a branch off of a giant tree. And really, unfortunately, it needs to be treated with herbicide. And so that one's the one that gets about waist high. It's pretty small compared to the other two.
Flower?
The flower is anywhere from a light pink to a white, and it's about the size of a dime or a nickel. So it's very, very small in comparison.
Isn't there a purpley flowered thistle?
Well, you're thinking of the first one you described.
I think people, they kind of describe it differently,
I see it
right?
As purple.
Purple. Some people see it as pink. Some people see it
that's
as violet.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Musk or scotch.
And that's the most common, I think. And It isn't an unattractive. It's actually very beautiful. You see a lot of bees around them. But
yeah,
then,
don't bees? That's a good point, Claire.
I'm
do bees
so
use it?
Glad you good. Asked. Yes.
Okay.
Bumblebees, leafcutter bees, mm-hmm. many bees use it. That does not necessarily mean it's a useful plant for okay. them. Unless they're specialists, which some of them are, but a lot of our native bees aren't specialists, right? And so are specialists.
Right.
I'm sorry, if they're generalists, weeds are okay.
Right.
The nutrition in the nectar and pollen in different plants differ.
Right.
The weeds that we have here, they don't have the same nutritional value that our natives have. And so if they're feeding off of those and they're natives and they're specialist pollinators, they can have some nutritional deficits. So while there, you see them in there digging around, they're there, they're available. They're gonna go to what's there.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it's necessarily a good thing.
Okay. So that's really good to know, because I do think that we see that and we think, oh no, this is a plant that the bees need, but not necessarily so, and they would probably go somewhere else if they weren't around. So it's not the end of the world for the bees.
Totally. And there is a native thistle that people confuse. And I would love the bees to be on the native thistle.
What is a native thistle?
Yeah, what's
like?
The differences?
Yeah, so this is wavy leaf, if you want to look it up. Wavy leaf thistle. It is also kind of a grayish, light green color leaf. The whole plant, really. And it's closer to the size of Canada thistle, right? It can get a little bit taller, but the leaves are really, really narrow compared to musk and scotch thistle. And the flower itself is maybe a quarter in size.
And this might be what you're referring to, Chris.
Right.
The one that you're talking about, the wavy leaf thistle. It has a little bit different flower.
Well, it's kind of a pinker, like, actually, almost a pinker, whitish.
Oh, boy.
Right. It's very confusing. If anyone ever wants to come out and do a thistle ID day, I am down.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that idea of a thistle. I think education is, at the end of it, the most important thing, right? And so I love that Mike reached out and educated himself on the best way to go about this. You have an event coming up Thursday. I believe it's from 5 to 7 at
yes.
Park City Mountain. And when people come there, are they going to get a little bit of an education about the proper way to dispose of the thistles?
Definitely. We'll actually point out all of the different weeds that are at the base there, because there are, if I remember correctly, at least 7 different noxious weeds. Most aren't very prevalent. Many people don't realize some of them are noxious weeds. So that'll be the education number one. And then we'll show you, for each of the weeds that we're going to control, what the best method is, because there isn't one method for every weed.
Of course. because they're saying you could pull the weed. I guess that's the most beneficial form of extracting the weed or killing the weed?
If it's a biennial, it sort of is.
Okay.
Right?
But that can be difficult, like you say, as deep root systems, not easily done, takes a long time, a lot of effort, etc. So, all right, so that's what's going to happen Thursday, starting when?
5 o'clock. So we'll meet. We're going to have a white pop-up tent near First Time Lift. We'll talk a bit about the weeds. We'll go tackle the weeds. We'll weigh them so we can see just how many pounds we have pulled from the mountain. And then, as always, with Summit CWMA, there'll be a little opportunity drawing. And Vail will be bringing some snacks and some beverages and bags. We'll have shovels, but anyone who comes, if you have thick gloves, if you have a hand
better.
Pruner, please bring those. It's much faster to clip all of the flower heads off and put those in a trash bag and then try and dig what you can of the big plant out than it is to try and just pull them out and put them all in bags.
Okay. So Mike, you were riding around and you saw these thistle or other, mm-hmm. obviously
yep.
other noxious
and
weeds
felt,
too.
And not
yeah.
just saw, but felt, right?
Sometimes, unfortunately, yes.
Besides just kind of identifying these locations, were you trying to harvest them in any way? Or
yeah, absolutely. I've been riding around with a much bigger backpack than I would prefer in a big contractor bag, and a pair of scissors and a knife, and I purchased a pair of, like, welder's gloves, big, thick leather gloves, and I'm that crazy guy out on the trail, harvesting thistles and putting the flowers in a bag and then pulling the plants that I can and kicking the other ones as much as I can if I can't get them out. And I've got a hammer and a little hand shovel. So yeah, I got all kinds of tools in the bag.
Is that effective? I mean, the answer, I guess the answer is yes, but is there a downside doing that, Sarah Jo? Not to suggest that you were doing, but make sure, let's understand how these weeds proliferate. And sometimes our best intentions might go a bit awry.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think what we see most often happening on the trail is, and it is, it's best intentions, right? Somebody sees a thistle, they pull it out, they put it in the trail, right? Because now you've killed the plant, you're putting it somewhere that it's gonna dry out and die. Yes, you killed the plant, which is phenomenal. Unfortunately, often the plants, by the time people recognize them, already have flowers. And there's enough nutrients in that plant that some of that flower is gonna go to seed. And so now you've put the flower and the seeds in the trail where the bikes and the shoes and the clothes and the dogs walk. So the seeds get carried further down the trail. So the intention is great, right? We're killing the weed. What can we do different is the question. And I think I even said to Mike that I'm a super nerd because I bike with a hand pruner and a Ziploc in my bag all the time. But you don't even need that, right? With a thick glove, you can just pop the flower heads off and put them in a bag. And then that plant out of the ground. And just anytime you take a plant out of the ground that's a weed, put it 1 to 2 feet off the trail. Even if you can't get the flower heads off, what you've done is ensured that it's now in a spot that people, animals, bikes aren't walking through it. So while we'll still have a weed problem there because there'll be seeds, it's not 10, 20, 30, a mile down the trail.
Mm. And when we're defining also the weed as these noxious weeds that really don't necessarily belong there, we're not talking about like other native.
Not at all. These are all of those plants that came from another country and that have been categorized by the state of Utah or by your county as a non-native plant that has the potential to significantly alter our natural resources, our economy, so agriculture, but I'm glad we're talking about it with recreation, right? Our economy in Utah is becoming more and more recreation-based, and so this is a perfect example of why it's important to Utah, and then also public health and safety. And I guess this kind of matches that too, right? Who wants thistle thorns in their hands as they're going for a hike or for a ride?
Absolutely. So it's that definition and that education, though, that I think is so important. So that's another reason why, Mike, I think what you did was so smart that you didn't think, here, I am the citizen, I'm just going to go out here and solve this problem. You understood that it was bigger than you, probably yourself and what you could do.
Yep, absolutely.
And you organized this group, and you say that you have already banded together to make sure that our community is approaching this in the right way and taking care of these noxious weeds in the right way. And there are a lot of different entities that are working to do that.
Yeah. There's, I don't even know how many partners, at least 30 different partners that work on this every year, all season long, if not year round, planning to be working on it the next year, bringing in grant funding to get this job done.
We're speaking with Sarah Jo Dickens. She is the founder, owner of the consulting firm Ecology Bridge, and Mike Sesney. Mike, well, besides, you know, other things, mountain bike enthusiast who kind of was the precipitator, so to speak, of this effort to go about host an event this coming Thursday for people who want to learn more about thistle, noxious weeds, and how to manage them, how to handle them, how to eradicate them from their homes.
Yeah,
right? Then take this information home, literally, and apply it.
Please do.
Or when they're out and about, hiking or biking, or et cetera. So Sarah Jo, why don't I just ride my mountain bike and in my backpack have 4 or 5 bottles of Roundup or dicamba or Diquad with me? Why don't I just spray them with herbicide?
I so love you asking that, because the way you're looking at each other right now is amazing.
We know it's happening.
I know. That's how I ask, because I see lots of landscapers to do it, HOAs who walk around on a weekly basis spraying, you know, this weed or that weed, and maybe sometimes it ends up not being a weed. Talk a little bit about the pros and cons of that activity.
First off, I do want to tackle this idea. Imagine someone on the trail with herbicide that's not a trained specialist.
Right.
Some people might laugh, but it happens. It really does. And often people are using an organic mixture. And I know we've talked about that before, right? Yeah. Like, just because it's an organic or natural mixture doesn't necessarily...
Like apple cider vinegar or something like that.
Yeah, vinegar, salt.
Some acetic acid.
And soap. Acetic acid can damage the soil. Salt most definitely damages the soil. Yeah. And so really being educated and trained before you're doing that in your backyard, for sure. On the trails, it's actually illegal. So people should not be spraying in public places if they're not being contracted and they're not licensed to do so. We would prefer you reach out like Mike did. Reach out, and you know what's the best is when you actually take a map and circle where you found it and send it to us. It was funny when Mike first started emailing, he was listing all these trails and then he'd mention like ski runs. I don't ski. I know that totally blows everyone's mind. I don't ski. So when you tell me it's near a run or a lift, I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So if people can drop a pin, show us on the map where it's at, and then don't expect that we're going to get there right away, because, you know, 500 miles of trail is a lot of miles to get to. But back to, you know, the use of just any chemical or herbicides in general, you do need to be licensed, because they do have the potential to have unintended impacts. You know, science is still out exactly to the extent at which herbicides impact natural resources and human and animal health, right? There are some research that shows correlations with some cancers and other illnesses. It's so hard to test for that. It will take so long to really be able to tease all of that apart. And so whether you believe that herbicides can cause these illnesses or not, there's absolutely no reason to expose yourself to more chemicals than are necessary.
Or others around you.
Exactly.
Or the animals that also are on these trails. And the soil, like you said, we want to keep our natural places as natural as possible. So while we love citizen science, there are certain parameters and boundaries that we need to adhere to.
Totally, yeah. And I think that becoming trained and getting your license to do that work, you're forced to understand what those impacts are. You know, people don't realize that when you're spraying, every minute you've got to be paying attention to increases in temperature, the change in wind, the amount of moisture in the air, what species are next to you. If you're using one chemical, can you stand next to a tree and spray that, or will it kill the tree? You know, a lot of people will reach out for the one chemical that they know, Roundup. And that's not even a chemical. It's actually a brand with many different formulations of many different chemicals. Yep. And so understanding what's in the chemical mixture that you're spraying is super important. It is what will tell you what will actually be killed. It's also important to read that label and understand where you can and cannot use this. Can you use it close to water? If you can't, it is illegal to be spraying next to water. I don't care if you're in your yard or on a trail or whatever, if it's not labeled to be used near water, that means that you're using a chemical that can easily spread into, pollute our waters, and impact our streams.
Right, which I don't think is necessarily uncommon, unfortunately, in this area near, I don't want to call out golf courses, but near...
But near golf courses.
But near golf courses.
Sure.
So discreetly I say that. But it is happening, and I do think education is key. That's why I love how this all came about. We love having you on the show, Sarah Jo, because you remind us and you educate us and you keep us informed about the best ways in which to go about this. And so I think it's always a helpful reminder to make sure that people are going about this in the correct way. So tell us again about when and where this event is and what people can expect.
Yeah, so we're going to meet at the bottom of the first time chairlift at Park City Mountain Resort Thursday at 5 p.m. And then we'll kind of fan out over the lower mountain and tackle some of this issue. There'll be some education from the get-go of what we're doing, how we're going to tackle each of these weeds that we may encounter. And we'll go and make a little bit of a difference.
Well, I love that this all happened. Mike reached out to me, and I think it's so cool that we have this opportunity to have this group of people that when you reach out, you're willing to go and say, okay, can you gather these volunteers together and let's go make this happen. So this is a perfect example, and we hope you out there, our listeners, are active in making sure that you're keeping our natural places natural and going through the right channels to do so.
Right.
Thursday night, 5 to 7.
5 to 7, or longer, if you want to stay longer. You know,
yeah.
It is addicting. I'm not going to lie. When you start to see how big of a difference you make, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's true.
It's addicting.
All right. It's true.
Sarah Jo Dickens with Ecology Bridge and Mike Sesney. We'll see you guys Thursday night. First time lift, make sure Sarah Jo drop a pin.
Yep.
Sarah Jo, so
drop
she knows where first time lift is.
Bring your leather gloves, drop a pin.
All right.
Let's thank again our first guest, John Valent, who is going to be at Park City Library with his book, Fire Weather, that he recently penned. And you have the opportunity to hear John speak at the Park City Library this evening.
At 7 o'clock it starts. So bring your thoughts, bring your questions for John.